free edition of Breaking Kayfabe with Baldwin and Barry. It's episode 145. With me is my man, Barry Rose. Rumor has it, Barry, before we get started, there's a very important topic we need to discuss. There is a rumor that you are getting ready to not only cut your hair, but to shave. Is that in fact correct? Because if it's true, Mrs. Baldwin is going to be very happy.
Yeah, it's absolutely true. It's now I'm starting to remember why I shaved my head and how happy I was. Seriously, it was like, I remember when I first did it and I was like, fuck, this is so liberating. And there's a sense of freedom. I don't have to do anything, but literally my hair. And when you see it in the photos, and certainly, you know, look, it's the first time in 23 years that I've actually grown hair. It takes me a while to whatever's going on up there to get it to look semi-normal. It's completely out of control. It's a fucking mess for the most part. So I've decided that, you know, and this was a lot of decision. A lot of it, I had to talk with my kids and all that. But I made the decision where I've got to shave this again. And my son said, "Cool, Dad, why don't you do the Maha Singh and shave half your head?"
Oh, there you go.
And I said, "You know what? There's worse ideas. I'll never have this chance again, most likely." And my daughter said, no, go Angelo Moore from Fishbone. Go the full out mohawk. So I don't know, Jeff, if I'm going to go mohawk or the Maha Singh before I shave everything off completely. But it is coming. But yes,
thank you for asking. If you go the full Maha Singh, you need to, before you go and take the rest of it off, you need to take a selfie and send it to Bob Roop. Just as a little tribute to him. So, of course, we have established that Mrs. Baldwin is not a fan of your current look. I feel compelled to ask the thoughts of Mrs. Rose. Does your current look repel her more than usual, or is she a fan of it, or what?
Yeah, well, so I've been repelling Mrs. Rose for many years.
Well, that's another story for another episode.
Yeah, we probably get a few episodes out of that, but yeah, absolutely. So, it was an interesting, I think initially, because again, this all started during, I think my last haircut would have been towards late February, somewhere in there. And as the hair was coming in, I would catch her staring at me like with her mouth wide open, like she's catching flies. And she would go, "I just can't believe this. My hair is really curly in the back, just like when you knew me 30 years ago, it's almost identical." We've gotten to the stage though, over the last 3 weeks or so, where she's like, "Yeah, you definitely need some sort of haircut to trim this shit up." So I think she actually wants the bald head back. And like I say, that's exactly what I want. So this was super cool though, because, you know, I took a lot of ribbing on Facebook, deservedly so, with the hair. And, you know, the big thing for me was, Jeff, I didn't know I could do this. I had no idea I could grow hair. And I thought for sure that if I ever did try to attempt to grow hair, that I was going to look like Larry Fine, you know, or Krusty the Clown, where it was grow on the sides and nothing up top. So I'm kind of shocked. I still have a bald spot in the middle. You know, that's, you don't see that in photos, but I have hair in the front. I have hair in the back. I got to be honest. I can't wait till I can just get in the shower and do absolutely nothing again.
If you go for the Maha Singh though, you definitely need to come, you know, downstairs, say, "Honey, let's go out to dinner. I'm buying."
Yeah.
See how she responds to that. So, all right. So let's take a look at what we're going to talk about today. We've got, honestly, parts of the show are going to be a little, I'm going to do a little something different. I'm going to kind of open a vein up on here on something. But before I get to that, we are also going to be looking at a match from 1979. Back when they called him Barry Black Belt Chris Adams, we are going to World of Sport, which I don't think, Barry, have we done a match from World of Sport?
I don't believe we've ever done a British match, have we?
Well, you know, we do Dynamite matches and stuff like that, but that's I don't think we've ever done one that was actually filmed or taped in England. So we are talking Black Belt Chris Adams, like 1 year into his career, versus one of the really underrated guys of all time, a guy that was very prominent in the early 80s in New Japan, and that's Mark Rollerball Rocco, who is just a terrific old school, like sort of, he's like Les Thornton, kind of a sneaky heel, but he's not as, you know, not as much grounded. He's more of a, you know, got some flying to him and stuff like that. And here's something we haven't done in a while, Barry. We're doing a top five list. Boom.
Wow.
Hey, guess what? Anthony Rankin from Lancaster, Kentucky. You thought we forgot, but no, I don't ever throw away a suggestion. And almost one solid year ago, Barry, Anthony said, give us your top five gangster movies. So, Anthony, 1 year later, my man, we are answering your wish. And I am going to throw this at Barry because having just recently completed my last hospital stay, I was very fortunate, Barry, because AMC, I want to say on Wednesday or Thursday of this past week, ran a season 5 marathon of Better Call Saul, and I was able to catch up. So we're going to talk a little Better Call Saul before we do the go home. But what I wanted to start off with is, as some of you may have seen posted on my Facebook page and discussed, I have finally finished all 6 rounds of my chemotherapy. As I told the listeners a couple weeks ago, I was diagnosed as being cancer-free. I was very, of course, very happy about that, needless to say. But they decided to go and do 2 more rounds sort of just to make sure. As I was reminded by somebody the other day, this does not mean I'm cured. This means I'm cancer-free. Typically with any sort of cancer diagnosis, it's usually a good, if not a couple of years until they will officially declare you to be cancer-free. And of course, there's always the fear that it comes back. And unfortunately, my doctor told me if it comes back, that's usually not a really good thing. But what I thought I'd do is I wanted to go back now that this thing is, for now at least, over and go back and talk about some of the things that I've gone through and some of the experiences that I've gone through and the way that this has changed me. And Barry, when you get that diagnosis, man, you talk about a life-altering thing that happens to you. And I've as we go on here, I've invited Lou and Barry to feel free to ask questions because, cancer is, it's something that unfortunately touches so many households in this country. And, a lot of people don't really understand what it's like to go through it. I certainly know, my entire family has been touched by this because, as I've mentioned before, my parents and my sister are all cancer survivors. My sister had a single mastectomy. My mom was able to have breast cancer treated with radiation. And my father, much like me, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and he had his 20 years ago and is a survivor and now get ready to turn 90 years old here, Barry. 92. Thank you. My wife having to remind me how old my dad is. That's pretty sad. But my story starts, Barry, it was interesting because I was looking at Twitter the other night and somebody was talking about, I think someone was talking to Dave Meltzer on Twitter and they were talking about having issues with their stomach. And Dave was responding and saying, that's not something you need to ignore when you have a lingering situation with your stomach. And quite frankly, towards the end of February of this year, I began having an issue with my stomach. It was not like, hey, I, had some, bad food or something. I mean, it stayed with me for a week or two. And it was a, pain in my lower abdomen. And it was more like, what the hell is going on? I've never had this kind of pain before. This is weird. And I, of course, made the extremely intelligent decision to go travel to Florida with my wife because she was going to visit her brother, who unfortunately is no longer with us. And I went down there and I was already having problems. We laughed about him here on the show where I was vomiting. I talked about that my wife and I had gone to Chili's one night. And the next morning I'm sitting there taking a shower and I threw up in the shower. And then of course, Barry, I had my own, Ethiopian like experience where, I joked here on the show about how you're sitting there watching TV and you're thinking, oh, I'm going to have I'm going to fart here. Oh, wait a minute. That's not a fart. That's a wet fart. And I'm doing the sprint to the bathroom and I didn't quite make it, and these are things where I was like, what the fuck is going on here? And so when we got back, my wife had set up an appointment with the thing was, is we didn't have a doctor here yet. We'd been here about 6 months by this point, but hadn't, scheduled a doctor's appointment. So we get a doctor. Our doctor is Dr. Kira Colbert. And so I went to her and, she's doing the usual blood work for a first time patient. And I mentioned that I've been having some stomach issues and You know, and she's, you know, so she was asking me questions about, you know, the usual things. Are you been eating something wrong? Or, you know, then I'm like, no. And when I went back a few days later to get the results of my blood work, I mentioned again that I was having, still having stomach issues. And she said, yeah, she goes, that's really unusual. I think I want you to have a CAT scan. And, you know, the funny thing is that she told me later that she would never usually have done something like that. Something told her that she should send me for a CAT scan. So I go for a CAT scan, and, you know, that's where they do basically like, it's sort of like an X-ray of your insides. I go and do the CAT scan, and I have an appointment with her. You know, my wife comes in with me. This is like maybe 2 or 3 days later. And having your doctor look at you and say, I'm terribly sorry to tell you this, but you have lymphoma. Getting kicked in the nuts with a pair of boots could not have doubled me over anymore, Barry. Like all of a sudden, I'm 58 years old and I've been diagnosed with cancer. And I sit there and my wife asked all the questions because I was just absolutely dumbfounded. I, you know, didn't know what to say, didn't know what to do. I'm not ashamed to say that when I went out to my car, my wife was sitting there with me. I burst out crying. I said, am I going to die? Because, you know, you hear that C word thrown at you and that's the first thing you think of. And, you know, so my doctor immediately set up an appointment with a an oncologist. This was on a Wednesday. She said the appointment was for Friday. And I went in and I saw Dr. Steven Szabo, who's a very well-known oncologist here in this area. And Dr. Szabo looked at me and he noticed that I was dehydrated. He actually, Barry, leaned over and put his hand on my stomach and said that he could feel the growth on my stomach just by like pressing on my stomach. And that's pretty friggin' scary. You know what I mean? Oh, and, yeah. You know, and he said, I think I'm going to admit you today. And I'm like, say what? And he goes, yeah, I think, you know, you're, and you know what he did? And in retrospect, this was good. He said, yeah, you really look dehydrated. I think I need to get some fluids in you. He didn't say, we need to get you in the hospital right now because I can feel the growth in your stomach now, you know? So I was admitted that day in the hospital. And the next time that I had an appointment with Dr. Szabo, he told me, you know, as I consider it and look back on it, I think if I hadn't admitted you that day, I think you would have been dead before the end of the weekend. Because what had happened was the lymph nodes in my stomach were metastasizing 2-for-1. You know, they were expanding at such an exponential rate that the cancer was growing that quickly. And that's one of the things about non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, just to kind of inform everybody here. It's good and bad. It's the most treatable kind of cancer. That's the good news. The bad news is it's also the fastest developing and fastest reacting, and the one, if it's not treated, that can kill you quickest. That's the proverbial Hobson's choice, huh, Bear?
Oh.
So anyway, so I get admitted to the hospital. I have like a 2 week stay. The first week I'm getting, you know, fluids in me because I'm so dehydrated, and they begin the treatment. And that was, and I discussed this a few months back when I first was diagnosed. That was the first night when they began the chemo. I reacted badly and had to have morphine because I was in so much pain that first night. Now, I have to tell you, when you're on a cancer ward and on the cancer floor, you hear a lot of stuff. A lot of people that are in pain, a lot of people that are in misery. That was the only night that I really had a miserable night. I am incredibly lucky in that I, for all that you'll hear me kind of complain and whine about seemingly, I handled the chemo pretty damn well. And not because I'm any kind of, you know, tough guy or anything like that. For whatever reason, my body didn't react to it the way, other than this one first time occasion, you know, my body took it pretty well. I ended up losing 65, 70 pounds during my treatments. It's a hell of a way to have to lose weight when you've been overweight your whole life. But typically what would happen is it would be a 6-day stay. And what they do is they rotate your medicines the way they were treating me. Now, of course, if you're on an outpatient basis, it's completely different. But I was inpatient. So what they do is they hook you up to a bag the first day, and you take the medicine. That's a 24-hour drip. When that's done, you switch out. They put in the second medicine. There's, you know, obviously five or six different medications, and they put you on a 24-hour drip for each medication. You also have to get like this. There's a special sort of bath that they have to give you, like a it's like a not a sponge bath, but there's a chemically treated wipe that they have to give cancer patients because of, you know, obviously, you know, part of what chemo is, it's a poison to treat poison that's in your body, you know. But so while you're doing this, you sit there and it's incredibly boring watching the bag, you know, slowly drip into your veins. One of the other thing is every single day that you're in the hospital, they wake you up at 5:30 in the morning to draw blood. Now, there's two different ways that they can treat your chemo. They treat it with what they call a PICC line, where they put a line into your arm, and then they have a thing called a port, where they basically implant in your chest a line that they can access. And after the first round of chemo, I got a port that I still have in me, and I will have in me until I'm finally released, and I'll get to that in a little bit. But because they have to draw blood and they can't access the port because that's where they use, you know, to treat your chemo and stuff like that. So what they have to do is they have to come in and basically stick you with the needle every morning at 5:30 in the morning, which is, that's a hell of a way to wake up, Barry, as you can imagine. And then, of course, at least 10 times a day, they have to check your vitals, you know, blood pressure. They check your, you know, your oxygen level. They check your, you know, then they check your sugar. My fingers are numb because what they do is they it's the old George Carlin joke. They prick your finger, which is, of course, better than fingering your prick. And so they tap you and, you know, get blood, and they have to see where your blood sugar is. And it's a never ending battle because what they do is when you're on chemo, because they need to keep your strength up and stuff like that, they give you prednisone. Well, one of the things that prednisone does is it spikes your blood sugar levels. Well, this past time when I came in, my blood sugar was like 90, which is actually really good for me. And then they give you prednisone, and, you know, a couple hours later, your blood sugar is at like 300. And they're like, oh, we're worried about your blood sugar. Well, no shit. You just gave me prednisone. Of course my blood sugar spiked. And, you know, God forbid you should have a ham sandwich or something like that. And they're giving you crap about it. And I'm like, you know, I'm sorry. If I'm sitting here eating six Butterfingers today, I can understand you being a little upset with me. But guess what? You just gave me medication that's going to spike my blood sugar. I'm not worried about it, really. Anyway, that's part of the daily activity of what I do. And what I would do is I would do a 1 week in. You get approximately 2 weeks out to basically kind of recover, and then you're back in again. And it's six rounds. And they give you, as I've discussed before, they give you something called Neulasta, which Neulasta, what it does is they give you a shot into your stomach, which that's always fun. And the Neulasta will cause your white blood cell count to go up because, of course, when you're taking the chemo, it attacks the white blood cell count. So they want to boost your white blood cell count, and it helps you, you know, recover and stuff like that. The experience, you know, I look in the mirror and I see, you know, all the weight I've lost. I see the hair that I've lost. I see the scars on my arm from all the, you know, the needle marks, like I'm some sort of junkie down at Needle Park. And, you know, I see the way that, you know, I lost strength. I see the way that I have trouble getting up the stairs and coming down the stairs. I feel unsteady. Oh, and here's another fun thing, Barry. When you take the chemo, one of the things that also happens is you generally get up and have to go to the bathroom about six times a night. And when you're in the hospital, of course, you're hooked up to the chemo bag. So they have the little cart there that the bags are hanging from. And when you have to go to the bathroom, you have to drag that with you. And then the other thing is because they have to monitor your heart, because as my wife reminded me yesterday, that you're putting all this poison in your body. And so they need to, you know, they put the little, like when you go for a stress test or something like that, or, you know, they're checking your heart and they put all those little sticky things on your chest, Barry. You know what I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So, of course, when you're like me and you have some hair on your chest, when it comes time to remove that,
oh yeah,
that's loads of fun, let me tell you. But, you know, that's another thing. I have to hang, they give you a little thing to hang around your neck. You have to, not only when you go to sleep, do you have this chemo bag hooked up to you that you have to arrange yourself laying in bed to have the chemo line to where, you know, it's not going to be impacted, but you have this EKG thing hanging from your neck. So, you know, it doesn't make sleeping very easy, Bear. You know what I mean? You got the chemo line, you got the sort of the EKG thing hanging there, and it doesn't make sleeping a real easy proposition, needless to say.
Yeah, you know, I think the one thing, and I remember, you know, because obviously you and I are, you know, this isn't just a podcast, and I should say too, I got a message this week from somebody that is in television production, and I shared this with you, and they said, you know, I've been listening to a bunch of your episodes. I just went through all the unsolved mystery episodes. He brought up Toadstool Tank, which was one of my favorites. But he said, he goes, you two really have this great chemistry together, which you don't really hear. And it's because we are friends. This is not, you know, I wasn't selected randomly. I was your friend. And this is an extension of our phone calls. But when you first told me what was going on, and you obviously, you had no idea what you were about to face, you know, you were telling me about the stomach issues you were having, and it was impacting you, and much like me, look, you love to eat. It's, you know, if anything, there's a lot of times, Jeff, that I eat, even if I'm not starving, I eat because I like the taste of food, and I think you're in the same boat. We both love to eat, and you were concerned, if I recall correctly, that you may have an ulcer. Yes. And I remember thinking to myself, all right, you know, you got an ulcer, but we can deal. You can deal with it. And I don't think cancer ever came up during the conversations we had. I don't think it was something you were thinking of, or if you were, you weren't sharing that with me. But certainly in my mind, it wasn't. And then I remember the first time that I think you had gone to the doctor, and the doctor said, there's a possibility this could be cancer. And I remember, you know, in my head doing everything I could to convince you that, hey, this is probably not going to be cancer. Let's try to stay positive and try to do this. But the end result to all of this is how you handled this situation. And a lot of it, look, a lot of the credit is got to go to your wife. Your wife is an amazing human being. But you really, you know, if it was me, I don't know how I would react. But I got to say, I don't think I could have reacted as well as you did. And you really threw this, at least public facing, have been a rock star, because, you know, I know that in your head, you know, there were times you were afraid that you were facing a death sentence. And I know that. And it's, you know, I guess I've never had to face that personally, but I don't know if I could have in any way handled your situation and what you've been through. You were fucking recording this podcast from a hospital bed more than once. Let that sink in, people, as you hear that. That's how important this podcast is to Jeff. He was in a hospital bed going through treatments, still recording. I can't say, as much as I would like to say it, I can't say that I would have the same kind of resolve that you have. Because if somebody tells me I have cancer, I'm on fucking medical leave. I'm shutting down, and, you know, and
you,
I just
would not support the Arcadian Network and the great Brian Lass. Is that what you're trying to say?
I'm trying to tell you that I would be the most selfish motherfucker out there. And I'm looking at every aspect of my life. But to that end, and look, and I say that, and obviously there's a bit of joking to that, but, you know, it's also understanding, and you and I have talked about this off air, there are times when we may be having not great days. I'm not talking about cancer. I'm talking about maybe trivial bullshit, and really more myself, where maybe I'm like pissed off or I've had a bad day. But the truth is, we start recording and I'm in a great fucking mood, and I hang up at the end of our recording, and you know, it's all over, and I'm in a really good mood. And it is the podcast and interacting with you and interacting with Lou and just talking about stuff puts me in a better mood. So when I say that, I'm saying it from this side, obviously, because maybe if I did ever have to face something that you had to face, maybe this would be therapy. But to that end, it takes a special kind of person to say, I'm going to continue recording. And again, I bring this up. We're 145 episodes. We've never missed a week. And there's no other podcast out there, I think, that can say that. There's no specials. There's no rehashing of old material. Jeff had cancer. I mean, he had fucking cancer. He showed up every week to record. I mean, there, you know, that's almost speechless. I got to tell you, and I don't want to, you know, I don't want to monopolize. This is your deal right now. I love you. And that should be no secret to anybody that listens to this. And the older I get, I'm very in touch with my feelings. I'm very aware. If this had been a rockier road and if I had lost you, I don't know. Obviously, the podcast would have been done. But on a personal level, I don't know what I would have done because it would have been an absolutely huge blow for me to be able to deal with something like that. So, you know, I am thrilled. I want to celebrate that you have finished up chemotherapy. And I know, you know, I know the verbiage that goes with it, that you're cancer free, which doesn't mean you're cured. But at the same time, you're cancer free and you do not have cancer right now. And I also know that when you went into this, I anticipated, and I think you did as well, that this road was going to be a lot longer than maybe 6 months. And I think that, you know, I thought you think that you were looking at a longer road. I definitely thought that this was going to be something that was going to go much longer than 6 months. You came, you saw, you kicked its ass because you literally, without hesitation, 6 rounds of chemo in just a few months. And you are cancer free. And that's absolutely huge. I love you. I'm thrilled. Let me shut the fuck up now.
A couple things that you kind of reminded me of is what happens at this point. I will follow up approximately once a month with the doctor. And the doctor told me that, as I mentioned, I talked about a CAT scan that I had initially. And I believe they'll rotate for at least a good 6 months. 1 month, I'll get a CAT scan, which, as I said, is sort of like taking an X-ray of your stomach. And the next month, I'll get what they call a PET scan, which is sort of like getting an MRI without having to go through that fucking tube. It gives a more detailed look at your inside than the CAT scan does. So then after that, at some point, I'm sure that it'll be maybe once every 3 months, once every 6 months, I'll get followed up eventually I start winding down. One of the things I asked the doctor was, I said, how long before I have a sense of normalcy to my life? How long, you know, when you were talking there, Barry, I was reminded as you were talking about food. One of the things that really was impacted in my life as we talk about our mutual love for food and stuff like that is when you start taking chemo, it completely changes your taste, your sense of taste. I used to be a complete fiend for Pepsi and Mountain Dew. I don't think I've sat down and drank a full Pepsi or Mountain Dew since the end of February, which is, quite frankly, anybody out there that knows me will tell you that's amazing. There are foods that I will taste. It's really funny. Something like a bag of pretzels or a bag of Fritos or something like that, like a salty snack. I don't have a problem with that, but like we have a dish of candy that's been sitting on our kitchen counter for 4 months that I haven't touched, you know, stuff like Payday or a Butterfinger or a Baby Ruth, because I can't eat candy for whatever reason. The taste of sweets, you know, I'm sure this is good for me because I'm not eating that stuff, especially, you know, with my blood sugar, but it completely altered my taste buds. And what'll happen is, and I told you and Lou this before we started is, you know, when I take the new Lasta, which I'll get a shot when the show comes out, it'll be the day before, but it knocks you for a loop and it starts affecting your sense of taste. So things that maybe all of a sudden the pretzels and the Fritos will kind of repel me for a few days. And then like a week will go by and I'll pick up a, you know, bag of chips and I'll have no problem with it. I still have problem with the candy. And that's one of the things the doctor told me. It's going to be a 6 to 8 week proposition for the chemo to get out of my system fully and, you know, to get back to a sense of normalcy. Hopefully that means I won't have to get up six times a friggin' night to go to the bathroom, you know, and because essentially, you know, what happens is you pee the chemo out of yourself. You know, when you go and urinate, that's what you're getting rid of is the chemo that's in your system, the poison that's inside your body, you know. And at some point, you know, I had this not just because of them doing the checking for my blood sugar, but I have numbness in the tips of my fingers. And, you know, every time I would go in there, he would say, oh, yeah, you have numbness in your fingers, don't you? Yeah. How do you know that? Yeah. He goes, that's everything. Everything that's happened to me is because of the friggin' chemo, you know, the sense of taste, the whole tiredness thing, the getting up all the, you know, times during the night. It's because of the chemo. And again, you're putting poison in your body to fight a poison that's grown in your body, you know, and it's poison fighting poison. And, you know, unfortunately, I was joking with my wife last night, my hair will not come back to full Barry Rose-esque, you know, I don't think I'll be able to pull off the Meha Singh thing. I'll be able to pull off the King Curtis, you know, I don't know that it'll ever come back. It's weird because my goatee, when I first went in there, he told me, yeah, you're going to lose your eyebrows. You're going to lose your mustache. You're going to lose your goatee. I've had a goatee for 20 stinking years, Barry. And he says, you're going to lose all that. And I never actually lost. I still have sort of a wisp of a goatee. It's not certainly not a full thing, but never lost the eyebrows. But I lost the hair on my head. And that's one reason. Yeah. And you know, the hair on my chest. Which, you know, that's very weird, having a bald chest after all these years. But so anyway, I'm glad that's done. Needless to say, you know, the monotony of having to go in and do that week of drips and being hooked up to machines for 6 days and then come back and knowing that you're going to have a week where you basically feel like shit. And then you'll have a week where you start to feel a little bit better and then you got to go do it all over again. And the monotony of that is something I certainly will not miss. I do want to say that, as I mentioned on my Facebook page, in case the group didn't see it, so many people reached out to me, whether it was just sending me a note, hey, man, I'm thinking about you, you know, take care of this thing. I had people that sent me little care packages, whether it was a hat or a DVDs, shirts, whatever. I completely was overwhelmed by any, even the slightest little gesture. I can't even begin to express my appreciation to everybody that did that. It really, really meant a lot. You know, I had somebody that said, hey, did you watch the DVDs? And it's like somebody that sent me, I think, like 25 or 30 DVDs, Barry. And I'm like, no, I haven't had a chance to get around to those yet. You know,
so, or is it Roman Gomez or Kevin Orcutt? Who was
it? No, it wasn't. It wasn't Kevin or Roman. All right. I can't remember who it was, but I have them sitting in a basket by my couch. I'm sure I'll get to them eventually. But, you know, just people were so thoughtful and it really meant a lot. And, you know, Barry, let me just say, as I'm sitting here talking about my recovery and getting over it, I know that you posted this morning, I believe, that that David Jordan, was it his father that he lost?
Yeah, David's father passed away. And our old buddy, Pete Lederberg, lost his stepmother over the last few days. And Pete, over the last couple of years, has lost his mother, father, and now his stepmother. And Chris Aja, we give Chris a lot of grief. A lot of it is deservedly so. But his father also is in the hospital and I believe is waiting for a diagnosis, but there is a chance that he may have cancer. So it's touching, you know, it touches everybody in the world. It seems to be touching our group a little. And obviously, you know, you're the leader, but it's touching our group right now a little heavier than I guess any of us would like. And, you know, and our thoughts, you know, I don't want to use the cliche, but our thoughts really are with everybody. Because it's a fight. Look, it's, you know, whether you've lost a relative, you know, somebody close to you or there's somebody's fighting it. It's really an emotional fucking thing to have to go through. So I think we, you know, Jeff and I are you know, we're always in the corner of the people that support us. And we wouldn't be doing this pod, you know, if we didn't have any listeners. I don't know, I shouldn't say that. If we didn't have any listeners, we'd probably still be doing this, Jeff. But realistically, you know, our group has been.
Are there podcasts that don't have any listeners? I'm just asking.
Yeah, there are. There are. There's a couple of them out there. Actually, more than a couple. But yeah. But so, but yeah. So- We're there.
I did want to say that I did see that about David and about Pete and about Chris. And so we're thinking of you, you three guys, and, you know, everybody else that's going through a struggle. So anyway, enough of the downbeat stuff. I did want to share what I had been through, because I hope that if one or two, you know, people out there have gotten some information, and, you know, God forbid somebody finds out in the next, you know, couple of weeks or months or a year from now, if they can use this and say, well, this is what Booker went through, and so now I have an idea of what I'm facing, it will be have been worth it. So what do you say, Barry, we go on to some happier things? Let's talk a little wrestling. How about that?
Yeah, I think we should.
Okay, I think we're going to, I don't have a specific date. I think we're looking at September of 1979, black belt Chris Adams, still so thin that he's wearing a shirt, Barry, versus the Rollerball Mark Rocco. Just a quick background on Mark Rocco, who's a guy that if you get a chance to do if you're looking to do a deep dive on a really, really good wrestler, a great performer, do a YouTube search on Mark Rocco. Mark Rocco, for those that don't know, was the guy that New Japan Wrestling brought in the early, you know, early 80s. Everyone knows, of course, that the original Tiger Mask, Satoru Sayama, his greatest opponent was the Dynamite Kid, Tom Pillington. But within the storyline of Tiger Mask, who, of course, was an anime character, Tiger Mask's rival within the anime storyline was a character called Black Tiger. And Black Tiger, they created a costume and a mask for the Black Tiger, and they gave the role to Mark Rocco from England, and which that really speaks well to what they thought of Mark Rocco. It's interesting, Barry, because I'm right in the middle of the Andre the Giant book, which, by the way, whoa, what an amazing read. Incredible, incredible details. So many stories about Andre's early days that I had no idea about him wrestling in France and in England and Germany. It's so incredibly detailed. Pat LaPrade and Bertrand Hébert, just top notch work done by these guys. Let me just say that. But the reason I bring that up is because they mention, you know, they happen to mention Mark Rocco in the book and Andre interacting with him in Japan in the early 80s and maybe even in the late 70s. But so Barry, you had a chance to watch this match. Tell us what you thought of it.
Yeah, Mark Rocco too. So what an amazing talent. And I don't know if he ever had any success on this side of the pond. I want to say I think he worked Calgary at one point, which it seems like a lot of the British guys, if they came anywhere over to North America, they were going to work for Stu Hart in Calgary. So I believe he may have worked some matches for Stu Hart, but never had a run in the U.S. And outside of England, I think Japan, as you mentioned, Black Tiger, that was it. His father was a famous wrestler named Jim Hussey. His real name is Mark Hussey. And he's also the father of a professional boxer in England right now. So you've got a family here of athletes, but Rollerball Rocco is, I think, maybe one of the most underappreciated professional wrestlers ever. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact of exposure, because most people don't know who he is. His stuff as Black Tiger, though, is, I think it's fucking riveting. And I think that was probably his best work, at least in my opinion. But definitely go out of your way to see these matches, whether it's against Sayama or somebody else. Who was Eddie Guerrero in Japan? What was his name?
I believe he became Black Tiger after.
So he did after. Okay, right.
Yeah, but like into the 90s, I want to say.
Right, right. It was definitely at least a 10-year, if not even longer, yes, gap there. And obviously, Eddie Guerrero, I think, is one of the greats of all time, without a doubt. So. Yeah, absolutely. So this is a really good match. And I've stated, as I do whenever I say anything, I'll say it multiple times, I love the British style of wrestling. And what I like about the British style of wrestling, it's hard hitting, it's wrestling, though. So even if there are punches or kicks and things thrown in, the basic what they get back to is wrestling. And it's such a unique style, the British style of wrestling. I don't think anybody else was doing this. And I've stated Billy Robinson to me was a god when it came to professional wrestling. And you can see, you know, as I was watching this match, and I just watched it within an hour of even us starting to record, I just blown away by the chain wrestling and what's going on here. Chris Adams, and I'll break kayfabe, but I don't know if I've ever said it. Chris Adams was at one point one of my favorite wrestlers ever. And this was probably at the height of his world-class days. I loved him with Gino Hernandez, but I liked him as a babyface or as a heel. I was a big fan when he went to the UWF. I think that tag team tournament with Terry Taylor, which led to Terry Taylor turning heel. Jeff, do you remember the press conference?
Of course.
Fucking greatest press conference. There's Tommy Gilbert, Dennis Brent. Yes, you know, there's like five people. Right. Exactly. There's the referee and the guy who does the UWF magazine sitting there. And then when Chris Adams shows up, Terry Taylor.
It was Dennis
exactly.
Brent.
Dennis Brent. Terry Taylor's got the greatest move. Terry Taylor grabs an ashtray. Do you remember this?
That was not empty. There was actually cigarette butts.
Yeah, but what does he do? He's so considerate. He looks at the ashtray and empties it and then hits Chris Adams in the head with it. It's like, it's the fucking greatest thing ever. So
I consider it heel.
Exactly. You really consider it heel. So I love Chris Adams. I was always a huge fan. I think there was a point there around 83, 84, where he was probably my favorite wrestler going at the time. That's how much of a fan I was of Chris Adams. And I hated seeing him in later years when he wound up in WCW, was basically brought in to do jobs, and that's what he did. Wasn't the same wrestler, but really just, you know, wasn't being used right, but to his credit, was getting a payday, and it was probably making more money at that point than he had ever made in his career. So, and then I certainly hated the way that his life wound up, and he was killed by his friend. Supposedly his friend killed him as they were drunk and there was a fight, and he had to grab a gun to defend himself. And he led a very troubled life, Chris Adams. And a lot of it, the common denominator, what people said about him was, great guy until he started drinking. And when he started drinking, you wanted to be nowhere near him. He was violent. He was mean. He was angry, just an all around bad guy. And, but again, if you saw him sober, apparently you loved him. You considered him a great guy. So I hated reading and hearing a lot of that shit because I was such a huge fan. This is super cool to me, though, because this has got to be the earliest Chris Adams match I have ever seen. He was going off the commentary. And I got to say, I love the British commentary. Weighing now at 14 stone, going into guys, yeah. They're so fucking deadpan. There's no voice inflection. There's no raising.
There's no David Crockett announcing this match.
There's not even like a Lance Russell, who was pretty even keeled as well. These guys are low key. This is like British guys calling a tennis match from the 60s to me. Yeah. Super fucking low key, but I got to admit, I really dug it. Because it gives it this real air of legitimacy. And listening to these guys commentate on the match and then looking at the people ringside who are wearing shirts and ties, and the women too, but you know, the women are wearing dresses. It's, there's something legitimate about this. That's what I really like. Chris Adams, you mentioned he's wearing a shirt. He's not just wearing a shirt. He's wearing long tights. So he's essentially got clothing on from his feet all the way up to, you know, his chest.
Well, he maybe weighs a buck 85. Let's be honest. He's not anywhere near what he was in world class as far as his weight. He was still really, he's a young guy here, and he hadn't put on, you know, he hadn't grown into his character. He hadn't really matured. This is still a pretty young Chris Adams.
I think, and if you listen to the commentary too, this is about a year after his debut.
Yeah.
So they say something how his improvement over the last year since he debuted has just been, they do mention he started judo at 14 years old and was 9 years into judo. So we're assumption here, he's 23 with about a year of experience underneath his belt.
And, you know, I don't mean to interrupt. His brother actually, I believe, went to the Olympics in judo, didn't he? His brother, Neil.
Yeah, he did.
Yeah.
He was a big deal. And then, and Chris Adams, too, they're calling him Black Belt. When he came to the U.S., I think L.A. was the first territory he went to. He was judo Chris Adams. And then I think from there, he may have wound up in Texas. But
have a run in Portland. I got to say that, because if not, we're going to get an email from Kevin.
So he may have gone. You're right. I think he actually probably went from L.A. to Portland, Portland to world class. That would make more sense. But long tights, full body suit, and no boots here. This is a barefoot Chris Adams, which is kind of bizarre to see as well. He does a lot of the judo stuff here. He's doing a front round kick, and then he does the super kick. Of course, they call it a mule kick, and he does it multiple times. The weird thing about this is the super kick or mule kick is not being used as a finisher here either. It's simply a transition maneuver, because he does it maybe five or six times throughout the match, but he lands a couple of them that are just fucking spectacular. Like, they're just beautiful to see. We talked about Mark Rollerball Rocco with his lineage, which is great. The crowd noise. So the crowd, and I don't know if some of this is piped in or not, because, you know, there's points when the crowd is silent, but then it does appear that Rocco is such an engaging heel that he riles up the people sitting ringside. And you could just hear the noise level just, you know, going up and going up. This is fought in rounds, which is the British style of professional wrestling. I'm not a fan. I got to say, and we're mentioning Kevin Orcutt a lot. So Kevin, we'll expect the check. You can make it out to Sweet Lou Kippelman. But, you know, the whole rounds thing, I'm okay with. What I really, and this made me think of it, was I hated the way Portland did it. And Portland would do, you know, two out of three fall matches. They generally were going three falls, but there was this break between falls that seemed to last several minutes. And they would do interviews and all this other shit in between the rounds. And I'm not really a fan of that. What I do like about these rounds, and I realized that this has been heavily edited as well, is that basically when one round ends, 5-6 seconds later, they're right back into a new round. So I like that, because it keeps me in the action. I do find the interviews between rounds and, you know, and falls and shit kind of takes you away a little bit. And I'm not really a big fan of that. This is the match does go three falls. Rocco does get the first fall with a tombstone pile driver. This happens in the fourth round. Adams comes right back, gets the next fall with a cross body block from the top rope. That's the fifth round. And then they go to the finish, and the finish, I think, and Jeff, I'll actually back off and I'll let you describe the finish, but holy shit, that was kind of spectacular, wasn't it?
Yeah. The bump that Chris Adams takes, Rocco goes to throw him over the top rope, but I mean, Chris Adams gets like full body extension. This is not like I'm curled up taking a bump over the top rope. I mean, he is like fully extended, so it makes the move look even more amazing. And he almost goes ass over tea kettle into this old lady's lap in the front row.
He does.
Yeah, it's a really amazing spot.
Yes.
You know, especially when you consider this is 1979. I mean, now, you know, of course, you know, with some of the stuff you see in, you know, different promotions now, it's kind of a thing. But for 40 stinking years ago, that would have been a pretty big deal, I have to say.
And I think it look, as I'm watching it, and Jeff said it, but let it sink in again for a minute. When he goes over the top rope, there's no curling. It's straight up in the air and then straight to the ground. It's super spectacular. And he winds up, at least his face does, in the lap of a woman sitting ringside. And then Rocco actually wins the match, I guess. Was a count out or whatever it was, but Rocco wins the match. But the ending alone is spectacular. To your point, Jeff, yes, you are 100% correct. The fact that this took place 41 years ago, if we had seen this during the early days of trading tapes, this would have been a holy shit moment for us.
Yeah, this is good stuff. We will post a a copy of this match, as we always do, on our Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry Facebook group, so you guys can take a look at it. I think, and Mark Rocco, let me just say again, he plays a really good, sneaky, kind of devious heel in this, you know, like not over the top, almost like a like an old time movie villain, you know. And it's just it's a lot of fun to watch him because you can see he's just having the time of his life out there, Bear.
He absolutely is, too. And he's such what's cool. And this is what I like about a second generation wrestler. He lives and breathes what he's doing. There's no half ass, you know, there's none of that. Mark Rollerball Rocco wasn't in this match. And again, I think the more spectacular of the two was some of the shit that Adams was doing. But Rocco's engagement with the fans, with the referee. I mean, he's in the referees, even the ring announcer. He so understands the psychology of wrestling.
Yes.
Does he?
Yes.
Does he do anything as far as training anybody now?
I really don't know that. That's a very fair question that I don't know the answer to.
Yeah, because he really is. And I know in my head I was going to, who's the guy from NXT? But it's Johnny Saint, who is their figurehead commissioner for NXT UK. Is Johnny Saint, who was another great star in England. But Rocco, this is, you know, if wrestlers, and I'm assuming that guys in England, that some of them are watching matches of Rocco. I don't see how you couldn't. But
No, you could definitely see like the NXT, you know, like UK.
It has to be.
Yeah. Some of the guys that are over there, if you watch them, you can, and then you watch a Mark Rocco match, you can definitely see the influence he had on those guys. I don't think there's any question about that.
Yeah.
So, all right, Barry, now we're going to pay homage to Anthony Rankin for having to wait a good solid year to have his top five gangster movie is listed. Barry, you ready to go on that, my man?
I am absolutely ready to go. And Jeff, I got to tell you, I switched up my list a little bit. Because you and I were texting, and if you remember when we were texting, and you pointed out, and I said, yeah, but is that really a gangster movie? And it's, well, it's organized crime, which actually counts. So I think you know what I'm talking about. I did make that switch, which I'm hoping you didn't have that on your list, right?
No, and let me just say that Barry's, I'm sure, one of his probably his number one, I threw Barry a bone here. Because the one that everyone is going to assume is number one on one of our lists, I threw Barry a bone on. I'm just going to say that. So when we get to it, I'll say, you know, Barry, I let you have that.
There you go.
So why don't you start off with your number five, Barry?
Yeah, absolutely, too. So and these really aren't in any particular order, though. I guess they are in some kind of order, as much as I want to claim that they're not. But Scarface. The 1983, which would be the remake, not the original version, but the 1983 Al Pacino, Stephen Bauer film directed by Brian De Palma. This was a big deal in my group, Jeff. So when this came out in 83, I was 19 years old. I was living in the heart of this, which was Miami Beach. The movie was essentially all filmed around South Florida and Miami. There's the Fountain Blue and all the big hotels and all the nightclubs. But it was such a dramatic movie when it came out, and it got so much press, so much play locally and nationally as well. And Al Pacino, and, you know, I have this relationship with Al Pacino where I sometimes like him, and other times I find he overacts and it's just way too
hoo-ah!
Much. That's what always gets me. I'm sure we've talked about that, but the hoo-ah always gets me. And I hate that movie for that exact reason. But with that, in Scarface, yes, the accent comes and goes. He's portraying, you know, you got an Italian New Yorker portraying a Cuban refugee, but he does a really good job for the most part. But this movie, it's a little hokey at times. It's definitely not boring, but it makes an impact on you. And I remember when I first moved to New York, I had already seen the movie, and I went to a theater and I wanted to see a movie and I didn't know what I wanted to see. And fucking Scarface is playing. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to go see Scarface again. And I remember enjoying it more the second time than I had the first time in the theater. Now I've seen it a million times because it's been playing on cable a lot, but I love everything about it. Start to finish, you've got some great actors. The guy who is, I know we're going to talk about Better Call Saul a little later, but the guy that was on Breaking Bad, and his name escapes me. He was in the wheelchair. His last name is, I think it's
Margolis.
Thank you. Mark Margolis is his real name, he's also in this movie, but there's just so many really good character actors. Robert Loggia is in this movie. He plays a great character.
Robert Loggia in that movie probably has more chains.
Yes.
Than any man that's ever been. He must be wearing, it's like Mr. T starting kit, you know?
Yeah. And he's another one. Look, another one that has a tendency at times to overact, but it completely works in this film. And if you take this film for what it is, I think this is one of the most enjoyable gangster movies ever made. Don't hold your breath for accuracy or anything like that. But if you really want to be entertained on every level, this is the movie for you.
Okay, before I get to my number five, by the way, Barry, since you said it's the remake, do you remember the original Scarface, who the star was?
It's one of two guys. And as I was saying that, it's either James Cagney or Edward G. Robinson.
1932, Paul Muni, I believe.
Paul Muni. Yeah, I think you're
that
right.
That was your third choice, I'm guessing?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So the guy or the movie that did not make my list, because I came up with six films here and I was trying to narrow it down. I really couldn't do it. 1949's White Heat with James Cagney, who you just mentioned, because I think that his performance as Cody Jarrett, a complete psychopathic gangster, is one of the great film performances of all time. So I just had to throw that out there. But my number five is 1993's A Bronx Tale, which of course was written by Chaz Palminteri, who's one of the stars of the movie. And I tell you why I like this movie is because it's a movie about gangsters, but it's about a movie about a guy who's played by De Niro, who completely plays against type as like the mild-mannered guy who drives a bus. While Palminteri is the gangster, it's about a guy that's trying to save his son from that whole lifestyle. And the son, of course, is being seduced by the gangster lifestyle. And De Niro is just this working class guy who they live down the street from the bar where all the gangsters hang out at. And he's trying to save his son. And of course, there's the great scene where the biker gang goes into the bar and Palminteri locks the door and says, now you know, something to the effect of, now you're not getting away from us, or, now you're locked in, and they proceed to lay an ass whooping on the biker gang. But just a great movie, a great script. They found this kid that looks like some sort of junior version of Robert De Niro. And the guy, I don't think he ever did anything after this movie, the kid. But
He did, Jeff.
He did
do a lot after. Oh, yeah. So I'm guessing you don't know what he did after this movie?
Lilo Brancato. Is that who you're talking about?
Oh, yeah. Lilo Brancato.
Okay,
Jr.,
please inform me.
Oh, wow. So, Jeff, somehow in the world, the pantheon of pop culture, this has escaped you. Lilo Brancato Jr. did do something. He was part of a robbery from a drug gang that wound up killing somebody, and he wound up serving many years in prison.
He made something of himself.
Yeah, exactly. Got out of jail, and I believe was on at least one episode of The Sopranos when he got out of jail. But he was a kid. I think he had no prior acting experience whatsoever. They were taken with not only his resemblance to De Niro, but the fact that I guess he really was able to convey some really solid emotion. When the movie was over, I guess roles dried up, and he was part of a gang of, and they were either looking for drugs or robbing people to get money. He was a drug addict, and somebody got killed. It may have even been a cop, and I'm not sure of that one. Went away for a long time, got out of jail. I know that his release from jail, he wasn't the actual shooter either, but his release from jail was heavily picketed. But I believe De Niro and Chaz Palminteri actually put forth a good word for him, saying, look, the kid made a mistake. I know he was on The Sopranos. I don't know if he's done anything since, but it was a hell of a performance by him, though.
Yeah, and a really great film. So, okay, what's number four, Bear?
Number four is the classic Bonnie and Clyde. And I put this movie on for a couple of reasons. One, this might be the first gangster movie that I ever saw. It's certainly the first one that I can recall ever seeing. And it was just so impactful. Faye Dunaway, I was just, you know, Warren Beatty did a great job, but Faye Dunaway just blew me away with this film. And I remember watching this film, and I probably watched it on, for all you Miami and South Florida, it was like Channel 6, WCIX, on a Saturday afternoon, probably rainy, and I start to watch this film and I'm just completely taken with these two criminals. And Michael J. Pollard is in this film. What a great actor he was. What a bizarre human being he was. But this was one of his first roles. Estelle Getty is in this film.
Estelle Parsons.
Estelle Getty. I'm pulling the Golden
not
Girls.
One of, yeah, not one of the Golden Girls. Yeah.
Exactly. She was like the youngest Golden Girl too, wasn't she? And she like played like the mom, but it was Estelle Parsons, who I believe is still with us actually. And as a side note, Estelle Parsons had a couple of daughters. One is an actress who was in a couple of movies, The Legend of Billie Jean, if you remember, with Helen Slater.
Helen Slater, yeah.
She played the best friend, the girl. Christian Slater was the brother. And then there was a girl that was on the run with them. Her name is Martha Gaiman, and she is the daughter of Estelle Parsons. The other film she was in was the movie FX, where she played the assistant. And I love that film. Yeah, exactly. And Brian Brown married to Rachel Ward, who you and I have ruled over for years. The other daughter is a fixture in the punk rock scene of Los Angeles and has been since the 70s. Her name is Pleasant Gaiman, and she is a big deal. But I love this film. But what really stayed with me was the ending scene when they're killed. And spoiler alert, the movie's 50-something years old. But if you remember, there was something like 400 bullets that hit the car. And I remember watching this just going, oh, my God, I don't think I'd ever seen anything ever like this. And I believe that car is still on display somewhere. It's the Bonnie and Clyde death car. But just a great movie. If you've never seen it, I believe it won some awards that year. Seek it out. Definitely watch it.
Yeah, what's the movie that was just we were just talking about this like less than the last week or two with Kevin Costner and Woody Harrelson. It's like a Netflix movie.
Highwaymen.
Yes, and that you know, if you want to do a great double feature, watch those two films together, because both those films are really good. Three completely opposite, you know, viewpoints, but both really good stuff. Okay, my what are we on? Four here. That's The Chicago Way. Yes, it's Brian De Palma's The Untouchables from 1987. And this particular one, as much as Highwaymen was good because of Costner, The Untouchables is not good because of Kevin Costner, because, you know, he's actually kind of bland as Elliot Ness. But Sean Connery as the Irish, you know, beat cop, De Niro as Al Capone. And it's such a great cast. Andy Garcia, Charles Martin Smith. There's a guy that nobody had. Charles Martin Smith. Remember, he was Toad in American Graffiti.
Oh, yeah.
A great character actor. And Billy Drago as Frank Nitti. The great scene where Elliot Ness and Frank Nitti are up on the roof. And, you know, but this, to me, is just such a great look at 1930s Chicago. Al Capone, the way that he ran the city, and you know, they've mythologized Elliot Ness, you know, with the TV show with Robert Stack in the late 50s and early 60s. The movie really, to me, is not so much about Elliot Ness as it is about, you know, the character that Connery plays and the Al Capone character that De Niro plays. The Untouchables from 1987, Barry, what'd you think?
Yeah, I liked it a lot. I if there's a flaw to the film, it is Kevin Costner's wooden acting. And I think, you know, Kevin Costner, he's fantastic in The Highwaymen, which was the first. And I remember saying that it was the first time I've ever actually praised him, because I thought he did a great job. And I thought as an actor, he really expressed himself. But for the most part, his career has been like a cup of, you know, the most bland vanilla ice cream out there. And there was a couple of movies, this being one of them. I think with a more charismatic actor, you would have had a better film. He made that movie, the fuck is it, where he kidnaps the kid. Remember that film? He kidnaps a kid. He's like on the run. I totally forget what it's called, but he's just so boring. I did like No Way Out with Sean Young and Gene Hackman a lot, but not necessarily because of him. Again, fucking Hackman is God to me. And I love Sean Young. But Jeff, a little side note here, two guys that have retired that will never act again You just mentioned one, which is Sean Connery, and I mentioned one, which is Gene Hackman. You can only bring back one for a movie role. Who you bringing back?
Wow, that's a tough call because they're both really, I'm big fans of both of them just because you know that, I'm going to go Hackman.
Wow.
Because
you surprised me there.
Well, I think he's got a wider range. I mean, you know, of course I'm like the ultimate Connery fan is James Bond. And not that that was the only thing he ever did, but Hackman had, I think a more, you know, did we mention that Hackman was in Bonnie and Clyde, by the way? You know,
right, exactly. Yeah. Gene Hackman's in that movie too.
Yeah. So, yeah. You know, he has, you know, I liked some of the stuff he did. He did a movie called The Package, which was fantastic. Based on a old film noir movie called Narrow Margin. And he just so you talk about how Kevin Costner has, you know, you like this one. Gene Hackman was just so consistent. If you saw his name in the marquee, you know you were going to see a good movie because he just didn't make bad movies, you know?
Well, here's the thing. Gene Hackman could take a movie that wasn't great, and just by being in the movie, he elevates it. And there's a movie I watched on cable with Ray Romano, who I think is one of the least funny people on the face of the earth. It's a comedy called Welcome to Mooseport.
Yeah. And never saw fucking, it.
But if you like Hackman, you want to see it because he's in the movie and he's just that good. The last thing I saw Hackman do, Jeff, he was on an episode of Diners, Drive-Ins, yes. and Die. Remember that?
Yes.
And that was
talking about Scrapple.
Yeah, exactly. He's retired. I think he lives in New Mexico.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
He was at the diner, but he actually said something for the camera. I love the guy. I wish he would come back, but I know he's basically said he'll never act again.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. What's your number three, Bear?
So my number three, so this is a tough one, but I'm going to throw this in here. So Jeff, I'm going to cheat a little bit. Because I feel, because I want to fucking cheat. And that's what I do. But I feel that I can because I know there is a version that has combined them, The Godfather 1 and 2. And, you know, there's a lot of debate on which film is better. I personally think Godfather 2 is a better film than Godfather 1. But that's not, you know, Godfather 1 is like the standard bearer for films. I just think, too, for whatever reason, I was able to connect with a little bit more. And I got to say, my top three, this is where there's no order. Because a lot of people would tell you The Godfather, whether one or two, definitely not part three, but that Godfather 1 and 2 are the greatest gangster films ever made. Whether we agree or not doesn't matter. But even people will say that the first Godfather is considered one of the great films of all time, you know, even outside of the gangster genre. So for whatever reason, I've always connected a little more with two. I think I like the story. I like De Niro in two a lot, but Godfather 1 also spectacular. I have never seen the version though that puts everything in chronological order. And I believe, was it HBO? Somebody was airing it a couple of years ago. Maybe it was AMC, I don't know, but somebody was airing it, but they had everything in chronological order. And that to me just sounded like a fucking dream come true. And I never got to see it.
Oh yeah. I mean, they're both amazing films and that's why part three was such a disappointment. You know, part three, the real problem with part three, of course, is amazingly is Sofia Coppola's performance. She was so horrible and she's such a well thought of director, but, Pacino's performance in part three is actually really not that bad, but nothing compared to parts one and two. I always say that my favorite parts, if you put it in a, like, the De Niro part, and then the telling, you know, Vito Corleone is a young man. And then, you know, then you take the part where, the Godfather has his daughter's wedding and then, you know, you do it in that sort of order. My favorite part of the whole storyline is the De Niro as a young man, you know, as a young Vito Corleone, because it's so fascinating watching him move through the city and the scene where he's going across the rooftops as he's going to take down the Don that's been bullying the neighborhood. That's just amazing. And then I would say the part with, you know, the Godfather 1 with Brando and Pacino as a young man and stepping into the Godfather role at the end of that movie. And then finally, the part of it's part of Godfather 2 where Pacino is now in charge and he's dealing with the guys in Vegas and in Cuba. That's how I would do it as far as the, you know, my sense of the way that I like the film best. So, but I mean, there's no question that they're just, it's an incredible story. I enjoyed the movie so much. I went and read the book, and the book is really good too, by Mario Puzo.
Let me ask you a question. So, and I don't know this, was part 3 ever put into this whole chronological order deal?
You know, that's a good question. I really don't know that.
Yeah. So. That could have been more interesting because on its own, part 3, what hurts part 3, in my opinion, is calling it a Godfather film. And yes. because you're comparing it to the first, you have to. It's impossible not to compare it. As a standalone movie, it's probably not bad. Sofia Coppola and her lips, like her fucking lips were like, you know.
And the hair.
And the hair. I never saw anything ever like it. And the acting, great director. This is not an indictment. And I really didn't love Andy Garcia in this film either. He was a hot star at the time.
Yeah.
I think they viewed it as, you know, this would be a great, but I've never been the biggest Andy Garcia fan, so I wasn't thrilled. There were parts of the movie that I did like, though. So I wonder if this was all put in chronological order and interwoven, would I enjoy it more? Hopefully I would. Yeah.
Okay, so my number 3 film is a movie we've discussed on this show before. We had a episode where we talked about the top 5 movie fight scenes of all time. Remember that, Barry?
Oh, I loved it.
And I mentioned 2007, David Cronenberg's Eastern Promises. This is a look at the Russian mob in London. You know, Viggo Mortensen, of course, is best known for his performance as Aragorn in Lord of the Rings trilogy. But wow, Viggo Mortensen in this movie as a Russian mobster. There's a doctor who's trying to find the information on a woman that showed up dead in a hospital, and she has to go talk to these Russian mobsters to try to get some information on her. And Viggo Mortensen, she slowly tries to get through the icy interior to get some information. But as great as this movie is, and it's a really, really good movie, with a absolutely fantastic, you will never forget it, knife scene that takes place in a bathhouse, Barry. Oh my God. I can't even imagine filming that scene.
Let me stress what Jeff just said. And you need, if you don't want to watch the movie, Google the knife scene. You have got. So when Jeff recommended this, I went and I watched Eastern, and it's a very good movie. This fucking knife scene is easily one of the best fight scenes in a movie ever of all time. It is absolutely unbelievable.
Thank you. I would agree with that, obviously. But one of the great character actors that is not ever mentioned, that is absolutely, you know, you talk about great villains. I talked about, as we started this segment, James Cagney as Cody Jarrett in White Heat. Armin Mueller-Stahl in this movie plays the head of the Russian mob. And what's great about his performance in this, I mean, seriously, this guy, this performance should have been nominated for some sort of Academy Award, because he is so quiet and reserved and yet at the same time so sinister. This is a guy that would cut out a family member's heart and not even blink, this character. And it's absolutely fantastic. He has no remorse, no compulsion to do any, you know, he's absolutely brilliant in this role. And
he's a great actor.
Oh, yeah. He's been in so many different things. Yeah. And it's like one of those guys, when I say the name, they're like, who? You go on the IMDb page and you look him up, and it's going to be one of those guys. You go, oh, that guy. But yeah, go for the knife fight in the bathhouse, but stay for the whole movie, because it's a really, really good look at the Russian mob. And, you know, the whole, you know, like you hear stories about the Yakuza and how they do the intricate body tattoos in Japan. Well, the Russian mob, according to what this the storyline in this movie, they do the same thing, the intricate tattooing, you know, and things you do to show your loyalty to the mob and stuff like that. Completely fascinating movie. I can't recommend it enough. Eastern Promises, Barry, that's my number 3. Tell us what your number 2 movie is.
Yeah. And Jeff, on that note, you ever been to a bathhouse before?
Well, not lately.
There you go. All right.
So I have been going through chemo. you know.
So. You have, right. All right. Yeah. So my number two, Jeff, is going to surprise you right now, because I know you, then you'll figure out what number one is. My number two is Reservoir Dogs. And this was something that Jeff pointed out to me when I sent him my list. And I was like, yeah, but does that? And he's like, yeah, it's a gangster movie. It's organized crime, which it is organized crime. You're right. So I definitely look, I've stated Quentin Tarantino is my favorite director. In the last 2 weeks, I've watched Hateful Eight for about the 10th time, and Django Unchained. I've seen Kill Bills, which have been playing on cable. I could watch Tarantino films again, and I do, again, again, and again. But Reservoir Dogs, what an impact that this film had when it came out. It was a big deal. And Jeff, I saw it in a theater in Broward County. I want to say it was a theater on Sheridan Street. Would have been like 92, and it was a real big deal where I guess there was such a controversy. And I believe the controversy was over the fact that cops were being killed and they were torturing a cop. But I think it was the ear cutting scene, which they found was just too graphic. But I remember walking up to the theater, and the theater had a sign that you enter at your own risk to see the movie, no refunds, which really is a fantastic marketing ploy, because it just makes you want to go see the film. And then when I saw it, I'm like, this is it. Like, this is what they were. And the movie's great, but I felt all the brouhaha was over nothing. But you've got some stellar acting here. This was the film that put Quentin Tarantino on the map. And what I think's great about Reservoir Dogs is I think it gets better every time I see it. So it's a film that when I first saw it, I thought it was great. But, you know, I watched it maybe within the last 6 months to a year, and I think it's even better. And there are so many little nuances in the film. Great acting. The greatest fucking Lawrence Tierney playing the patriarch of this film. And Lawrence Tierney, to me, here's a guy. This is, you talk about wild men. This guy was the fucking wild man. And this was a guy that was blackballed from Hollywood for years because he was just a fucking lunatic, just a, you know. But here was a guy that got this renaissance later in life. And Jeff, do you remember him from Seinfeld?
Of course.
Oh, I mean, master of the house. It's the, you know.
Now you're going to be humming that for the rest of the day.
Fight down, Coors Boy. You know, he's like, you're not wearing that jacket with me. The guy was fucking gold. So yeah,
there was actually a Lawrence Tierney movie on TCM last night, a movie called Bodyguard. And that was from 1948. So think about how long the guy's career was.
Yeah, he made all the, he was a really big star in the 40s. But then you've got these arrests for public intoxication. There was a lot of violence involved. He was a fucking, just Google him one day to see what his arrest records were. And then there was a period he wasn't making any films because I don't think anybody would touch him. Later in life, though, and I think Tarantino might have been responsible, Tarantino put him in his films and obviously Seinfeld. But I'm riveted every time Lawrence Tierney's on a screen. And Reservoir Dogs, you know, the funny thing with Tarantino also is I changed my list of my favorite Tarantino film. And I change it all the time based off of what I'm seeing. But it's certainly this film is certainly right up there.
So do you when you hear Stuck in the Middle?
Oh, absolutely.
Do you find yourself immediately flashing back to Reservoir Dogs?
And the funny part is, yeah. And then that's one of my ringtones on my phone. But at the same time, whenever I hear that song, I start to scratch my ear too, you know?
Okay. My number two best gangster film is from 1995, director Michael Mann's tale about a group of professional bank robbers. And here we go. We got the usual cast of characters here: De Niro, Pacino, a never better, may I say, Val Kilmer, John Voight, Tom Sizemore, just a stellar friggin' cast. And I'm talking about, of course, the movie Heat. A scene that was designated, I believe, by the U.S. military as being so believable and so realistic. I don't know if it was the military or maybe just police departments, that they used the bank robbery scene as a training exercise, Barry. That's how amazing the bank robbery scene in Heat is. Just an amazing scene. Michael Mann, well known for the way he sets moods and, you know, his use of lighting and stuff like that. And of course, before the movie The Irishman came out recently. This is the first movie where Pacino and De Niro had been in a scene together, you know, where they sit down at the coffee shop and, you know, Pacino tells him, you know, just so you know, if I get a chance, I'm taking you out. And they sit there and basically have an understanding that if he catches him in the act, he's taking him out. And De Niro says, you know, basically take your best shot because I'm going to do the same. I'll take you out if you try to take me out. And it's a great, it's a riveting scene. But yeah, so much about this movie that just is so great. And oh my God, Barry, that bank robbery scene is just absolutely amazing.
It is. You hit the nail on the head, too, when it comes to Michael Mann. So the knock on Michael Mann for years, and this goes back to Miami Vice, the TV show, which he was the creator and the guy in charge for years, was that he was style over substance. And he was great with visuals. He was great on getting this beautiful artistic shot of being able to blend the perfect music into a scene. But the knock on him would have been the plot lines and some of the dialogue. This is his best work by far. I mean, I think you've got Heat all the way at the top, and then everything else is going to be underneath. And while I love Miami Vice, the original TV show, I love it for a lot of the cheesiness factor of that show. You don't get that with Heat. Heat is, to me, I and I'm jealous that this is actually on your list. Now, you chose Heat for something else, and I forget exactly what it was for, but I remember we talked about Heat on the podcast at one point a year or two back, and I don't remember what it was about, but fantastic work. Val Kilmer's another one. So Val Kilmer is a guy, and I hate seeing Val Kilmer now. He's, you know, life has not been kind to Val Kilmer the last few years, but he's in one of my favorite movies, which I've talked about, Real Genius, numerous times. But a lot of his other work I didn't really like, but this movie, he's just blows it away. He was pretty good as Jim Morrison too. Hated him as Batman. But this is I'll say besides Real Genius, and I'm sure Val Kilmer would say Real Genius is not his best work, but this is probably his best work. Definitely Michael Mann's best work. But everybody's really good. And that scene where they're talking, where Pacino and De Niro were talking, that's such an iconic scene at this point as well. So this is a fantastic, fantastic movie.
Okay, so give us your number one, Bear.
So my number one, again, it had to cause me to go back and I dropped, I dropped Casino from my list, which I think is absolutely fantastic. It's a great movie, but at the same time, I'm a Tarantino whore. So I had to squeeze it in, but Kill Bill Volume 1, which at this moment is my favorite Tarantino film, especially Volume 1. I do like Volume 2, but the scene with, you know, it is about organized crime because they are a gang. But the scene with Uma Thurman fighting the crazy 88 is, I think, if we redid the whole fight scene thing, this would be my number one with a bullet because it's an amazing, amazing scene. The way, I mean, just all of it, the way it cuts back and forth between black and white and color. But, you know, the way it starts off where she gets the girl in the bathroom and then cuts her arm off. But, you know, the fact that she takes out, you know, all 88 of the crazy 88, but, you know, everybody else that's in there, Uma Thurman is a fucking goddess to me, a goddess among goddesses. There's talk of a Kill Bill Volume 3. I'm on my knees right now.
I'm down for that. I'm down for that.
Oh, fuck yeah. I would opening night. COVID, no COVID, Jeff. I'm in a theater. I'll put in a full body suit, whatever. I'm praying for it. But this is my favorite gangster film. And it's not a traditional gangster film. You know, there are, you know, Godfather, Heat. These are, you know, Goodfellas, whatever. These are traditional gangster films. This is an amazing movie on so many levels, though. And yeah, I really like it. I tell you, I would love for Tarantino to do a traditional gangster film, though, and obviously put his spin on it, because I think that would be really, really interesting. And he does seem to get on these certain genres. Obviously, he was on the whole Western kick for a while, and we got a couple of Western movies, and he was doing the whole drive-in thing, you know, and he gets on these kicks, and I really hope he takes a deep look at a traditional gangster genre and decides to do something.
Okay, my number one is from 1990, Barry, with the spoiler alert, mentioning it here a couple seconds ago. Director Martin Scorsese and Goodfellas. But I mean, what can you say about that? As far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a gangster. And, you know, you talk about Val Kilmer and how his career maybe peaked with Heat. And, you know, Ray Liotta is a guy that, wow, for a while there, he was so hot. And now he's doing commercials for like, what was it? Like a stop smoking thing or, you know, like a
Chantix or something, right?
Yeah. Just his career definitely hit the shitter at some point, but he was brilliant in this as Henry Hill, you know, and there, it's funny because, you know, if you look at the IMDb page, De Niro gets lead billing, but he's really not the lead role in this. You know, Jimmy Conway is not the lead character in this. It's Henry Hill. It's Pesci. It's, you know, Paul Sorvino, great cast. I mean, there's no question about that. And this was the mob and the, what is it? The 60s into the 70s. And then of course, you know, the book Wise Guys that Nicholas Pologi wrote, which so exposed the whole mob scene in New Jersey and in the New York metropolitan area or that area. But wow, just an incredible, and who can forget that scene where he takes Lorraine Bracco on their first date to the club, and that tracking shot where they walk through the back of the kitchen and the camera in one single shot follows them to their table, that the way, because the waiters have so much respect for who he is and, you know, who he's with, that they create a table for him and sit him right at the where are they going to see Henny Youngman, I think. And I think
you're right.
Yeah, but just an absolutely brilliant film, Bear.
It's a brilliant film too, and there's so many takeaways. What's great about this film, this is, and I'm sorry about that spoiler alert. And as I said it, I said, wait a minute, Jeff hasn't mentioned Goodfellas. And I didn't know what your list was, but there's no way Goodfellas ain't going to be in somebody's top five list, right? I mean, let's be honest. If you're doing this, Goodfellas was it. But here was the takeaway. Not only was this a brilliant film, and you can make a case, this might be the greatest gangster film of all time. I think it certainly it's going to be in that top three that you can massage around. But this is also, Jeff, where I learned how to slice garlic properly. Do you remember that scene?
You know, Paulie
just said it.
Very thin.
Yeah. And you just said it, because when you said Paul Sorvino, I'm going back to, so he was taking a razor blade and he was slicing garlic to the point that it's almost trans in prison, where it's almost translucent, and then when he puts it in the oil, it almost dissolves in the oil. So to me, that every time I ever make spaghetti sauce, or as the Paisans call it, gravy, I will, and I don't use a razor, but I will get it as thin as possible and get it in the oil so it kind of just melts in the oil, which gives it just tremendous flavor. So this film works on every, I mean, you know.
Not just on a gangster film, a food film, Barry.
It's a food, which, you know, I'm going to gravitate towards that. But I mean, and you're right about Ray Liotta too. Ray Liotta, and I don't know where it all went wrong for him. His debut that I remember was the movie Something Wild by Jonathan Demme, which is one of my favorite films, which stars Jeff Daniels and Melanie Griffith. He's fantastic. But this movie was really built around him. He was Henry fucking Hill.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So even though you've got guys, you know, you've got De Niro and Pesci, you've got these heavy fucking hitters in this movie. You've got Academy Award winners in this film. This was Liotta's star vehicle, and Liotta did a great job. So what happened? I was watching cable the other night, and there was a movie called Smoking Aces, and Ray Liotta's in that. And it just, he's part of an ensemble cast. It's not even his film for the most part. And now you're right. He's doing these nicotine commercials and looking kind of bloated. So I don't know where it all didn't go right for him, but he was so good in this film. But in this film, who's not good in this film?
Everybody.
And that's it. And that the star of this film is the director. This is fucking Scorsese. He has crafted a masterpiece with this film.
Yeah. Okay. So as we begin to wrap up, finally, I did want to mention, as I talked about at the very top of the episode, had a chance, Barry, and, you know, somewhere along the line during all my treatment, you and I forgot about the whole Better Call Saul thing. And what happened, to be honest with you, is I watched the first five episodes, and then somehow I missed 2 weeks. And during my treatment, I DVR'd the last three episodes, but I kept looking for those middle two episodes, I guess, which would be episodes 6 and 7. Well, here it is. They're running a marathon the other day, and I literally spent the entire day. And by the way, let me just say that TV programming in a hospital, you don't have a lot of channel selections. That's another part of the misery I went through during chemo.
But you have a roommate, by the way, Jeff?
No. And that's another thing. Thank God I can't.
Yeah. Imagine. Thank God.
But so I had a chance to spend all day watching all 10 episodes. How fantastic was season 5 of Better Call Saul?
Yeah, there's so the beauty. This is where. So I, when it comes to Breaking Bad, to me, it's the best show of the modern generation. If you were asking my favorite TV shows, Seinfeld, Curb Your Enthusiasm, Twilight Zone, Breaking Bad, probably Better Call Saul. This is so similar as far as quality to Breaking Bad. I felt Breaking Bad, the first episode, was as good as the last episode. Like, there was no drop off at all. They didn't have to wrap it up. They did wrap it up. They didn't have to. The show didn't suck. Breaking Bad is as good now, if not better, as it was 5 years ago. There's zero drop off in quality. And I got to tell you, I get a major boner every time Kim Wexler comes on screen. She is so incredibly hot. And here's a woman that is not playing this for sex appeal. She's in her late 40s. She is so fucking commanding. I am such a fan. What a great season. When you texted me the other day, Jeff, you were describing the scene. I think this was one of the most I was fucking white knuckling my couch watching that scene, Jeff.
Yeah, we're talking about the actors. I believe her name is pronounced. It's not Rhea. It's Ree Sehorn. And good Lord, if she doesn't get some sort of Emmy for this season, she is absolutely amazing as Saul Goodman, Saul Goodman's girl. Yeah, as his girlfriend. And the storyline that they have created. And, you know, one of the big fears that people talk about is because Kim Wexler was not part of the Breaking Bad world.
Yes.
Is what happens to Kim Wexler, because at some point she's either leaving or dying, you know, but Bob Odenkirk is just fantastic. You know, the range of emotions that he's go and the episode where he goes out, I believe the episode was called The Bag Man, where he goes out to the desert to pick up a money drop. Let's just say things go horribly wrong. But just a fantastic, if you have, you know, I somehow got my mom and my sister into watching Breaking Bad, and subsequently they started watching Better Call Saul. And my sister will text me and say, "Oh, we're watching Better Call Saul again," you know, and because that's one thing. This is not something that you pigeonhole, oh, only people in their 30s or 40s. I mean, you know, my mom is, well, let's just say she's older than 40. And, you know, the fact that she and my sister and people, you know, people that are like in their 20s, this is just a great, great program. And if you have not, who is it? Benji Fido said, "Oh, I'll have to check these shows out." Like, I was like, "What are you doing? You haven't watched Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. And by the way, don't watch these with Antonio, by the way." You know, probably not a good idea for him to be watching, but just a fantastic, fantastic show. Both of these shows are amazing.
Both are. So Giancarlo Esposito.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Thank God. Thank God they realized what they had, that they brought him from Breaking Bad into the show. Mike Ehrmantraut, played by the great Jonathan Banks, who, you know, here was a guy that was in all these movies in the 1980s, always playing a bad guy. He was in Beverly Hills Cop. He was in that movie Armed and Dangerous with the great John Candy, but it was in a million movies. But everybody shined in this show. And again, Vince Gilligan is a genius. I mean, the way everybody, every character means something, and you can connect with every character. Just tremendous. I can't say enough about this show. And Jeff, on TV, as we're discussing too, Perry Mason continues to blow me away. I got to tell you, Unsolved Mysteries, a little bit of a letdown when it comes down to it. I did watch the Paranormal episode, Jeff.
I knew you were gonna like that. Did you like the one about the French guy? That was pretty interesting, though.
Yeah, that was in Jeff. That's, we need to find the French guy, right? We need to get on this.
Oh my God. Guy wiped out his whole family.
But yeah. Like, how fucking bizarre is this? Like, yeah. Everybody that knew him was like, he could never have done it. But obviously he wound up doing it. So, yeah, that was a great story. I just don't know. I don't know. There was something about a couple of the other episodes that I just was like a little. The one on Alonzo Brooks where he was killed. He went to a party one night and there was. Didn't come home, but there were so many holes that were never addressed. So he had a fight with a guy. And this is probably a great time to talk about it. He had a fight with a guy at a party that was racially motivated, but they never address who the guy was or if the police ever had a conversation with the guy.
Yeah.
Like, there was just so much that was left out of this that they never told us. Like, it made no sense to me.
They do a whole grid search. They find nothing. The family comes out there, does the grid search. There's the body laying right there, you know.
Within 30 minutes. Within 30. So, yeah.
Very strange. All right. I think it's time for the go home, Barry. Definitely want to thank you and our man, Sweet Lou Kippelman, on production duties. I'd like to remind you that Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry, a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. And for my co-host, Barry Rose. Folks, it's good to be with you. It's good to be done with my chemo. And until next week, we will talk with you later.